to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Just to remind you, Dr. Pettus Perry won't be on the show today. He's still off doing great things and needs more time to do them, so he'll be back soon. Now, on with the show. Our program today is State of Confusion, Political Manipulation, and the Assault on the American Mind. Dr. Bryant Welch's most recent book, State of Confusion, was prescient in his prediction of the current American political climate. Dr. Welch wrote State of Confusion due to his increasing concerns with the growing instability of the American mind itself, as it struggles under trauma and political manipulation to bear the psychological burdens needed to maintain democracy. Dr. Welch predicted that the assault from the right would destabilize the ability of citizens to discern right from wrong, honest from dishonest, pushing our democracy into a slide towards dictatorship. We have big things to do. Dr. Bryant Welch is a nationally renowned clinical psychologist and attorney who has been observing the American mind as it has played out in the political arena for two decades. A graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School, Dr. Welch received a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of North Carolina, and later was a research associate graduate at the Washington Psychoanalytic Institute. He has won advocacy awards from the American Psychological Association and took a hard stand against their involvement in torture under the Bush administration. Dr. Welch currently lives and practices clinical psychology in Sausalito, California. To find out more about Dr. Welch, visit BryantWelch.com. Welcome to Be Bold America, Dr. Welch.
Thank you, Jill. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I am delighted to have the opportunity to speak with you about your brilliant book. You originally published it in 2008, and then you updated it a few years ago. What did you observe in our society in 2008 that caused you to write it? And since then, well, we'll delve into specifics, more specifics later, but since then, what are some of your general observations?
Well, I was in Washington working for the American Psychological Association in the 90s, and I saw a very marked shift in the tone and the nature of the debate in the political world. I think particularly in the Dukakis-Bush campaign, which goes back quite a while now, there was a growing use of media in a way that we hadn't seen it before, that to me seemed very clearly and powerfully designed to impact the mind and appeal to some of the baser motives in mind. And the whole tenor of things just changed in a relatively short period of time. So I followed that, and then with the Bush, George W. Bush, and 9/11, I think the deterioration that I'd noted became undeniable. So I wrote about most of these things I put together during the George W. Bush administration. But then as we encountered Donald Trump, it almost seemed like the things that I talked about at that time were now present on steroids. And we've had I think what most people would recognize as an undeniable craziness in the body politic.
Yes, so, definitely. Okay, go on. I'm just agreeing with you on that point. Craziness to insanity.
Well, agreement is welcome, Jill.
Oh.
So at any rate, in 2017 or 18, I just updated the book to show how the things that I talked about right around the turn of the millennium were really much more apparent, much more compelling, and much more dangerous. I also said there were some things that we were learning over that time that I thought were hopeful if we could apply them. But by and large, the deterioration has continued, and the hour is getting late. That's sort of the history of the book.
Well, your first sentence of the book I thought was really enticing. You wrote, "Do you think there just might be something a little off in America, psychologically speaking?" And you further say that the real issue in America is really what's wrong with our own minds. And again, to continue, what's wrong with our own minds?
Well, the mind is an organ like other parts of our body. It's the heart, the stomach, or what have you. And there are certain things that make it function well and certain things that don't make it function well. And the major task that the mind has is to help us develop a coherent sense of reality. There's an enormous amount of data that's bombarding the mind, both from outside the mind and from inside our body and our mind. And the mind's job is to organize that into something that at least feels close enough to organized reality that we can feel comfortable and secure, that we know what's going on around us. But if the demands on the mind become too great, as I argue they have, then the mind's ability to sort out what's real and what's not real begins to atrophy and begins to decline. So some of the crazy things that you're now seeing are reflective of that. Some percentage of the Republican Party think that, the country is run by pedophiles. And some of the QAnon material. But by and large, the ability of the mind to sort out and to sift information has deteriorated. And I think we can point to some pretty clear reasons why that is.
Well, why don't you point them out? Please continue.
Well, the mind has to assimilate information that's given to it. And if you look at what's demanded of the mind, just for openers, take a look at the pace of change. Every time there is a major change in where we live or how things are done, the mind has to assimilate that. It has to incorporate it and weave it or reweave it into our sense of reality. But if things come at us too quickly, we're not able to do that. And if we're not able to organize and make sense of the material that's coming into us, we get frightened, we get confused, and we start looking for more primitive ways to explain life and to manage our life. And one of the scariest is we look for someone else to tell us what's real, for someone else to tell us what we ought to do. And we look for someone who appears to be absolutely certain and confident in their ability to do that. Now that, as you will notice, begins to sound a lot like a dictator or an authoritarian personality.
Yes.
And that's why the risk of authoritarianism, it's that people don't want to take on the burden of freedom or the burden of independent self-thought. So as this pace of change continues to move, increase exponentially, the demand on the mind gets a lot greater. At the same time, the very things that support the mind, that help it do its job and feel secure and coherent, those things are under assault in a lot of ways. Connection, family connection. It's our connection to other people that makes us feel very secure. And if you look what's happened to the American family, we used to talk about the divorce rate. But now what we find is that it's not only the extended family, the nuclear family, and we find that a large percentage of kids are growing up without one of their parents. So these things that hold us together, neighborhoods and the sense of continuity they provide, communities, social structures, people's participation in civic associations has plummeted in the past 20 or 30 years. So all these things that support the mind are at the same time under tremendous assault. If you look at the role that professionals played in society, for better or worse, there was a sense that your doctors and your lawyers and your newspaper and your scientists were people who adhered to a certain kind of professional ethics. And all of those things, all of those professions have been assaulted. Teachers now are no longer free to teach in a way that makes sense to them, and they're just flooded with demands on them, limitations and prohibitions. So all of these professional groups that played an important role in society and helping people sort out what's real, what isn't real, and provided a kind of stabilizing influence, they're all under assault themselves, and their impact, their positive impact, is diminishing. So you look at all those problems that confront the mind, then you look at the body politic. And politicians have always been devious and manipulative. That goes back since the beginning of time. But what's different now is they have the instruments to really, really work on the mind in a subliminal and unrecognized way that further undermines the ability of the mind to function independently. You look at Rupert Murdoch. He made his mark on the world with overstimulating people and appealing to the primitive sensations in the mind. And that now has taken over the nature of the media as people try to compete with it. So you have a constant poisoning that's going on in the mind that is also increasing rapidly and exponentially. So you have politicians then can come in and use those instruments and deliberately stir up different segments of the mind. I talk about three of them in the book, of paranoid mechanisms, sexual perplexity mechanisms, and envy. But you can go into these different areas in the mind, stir it up, and you divert people's attention away from what kind of schools are their children going to have, and do they want health care, and should a woman have a right to choose. And instead, you've got them focused on some of the scarier aspects of the mind, especially, paranoia. I think since 9/11, the country's never recovered from 9/11, and the way it was it threatened the paranoid membranes of our mind. The same thing with sexuality. There's always something to scare people in the sexual area, whether it's gender fluidity, whether it's homosexuality or presidential indiscretions, whatever. With these new communication devices, politicians can come in and perform literal assaults on the mind that destabilize it. So you put all this together, and it's quite a soup that the mind is swimming in, and it's not so surprising that it's not functioning real well.
Well, this is a good time to take our break, and then I'm going to follow up on that. You are listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. Our topic today is State of Confusion, Political Manipulation, and the Assault on the American Mind. We're speaking with Dr. Bryant Welch, nationally renowned clinical psychologist and attorney. Visit bryantwelch.com to learn more. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
KSQD thanks the 250 listeners responded to our recent pledge drive, contributing more than $25,000 toward our operating expenses and $10,000 toward our Signal expansion campaign. Your support makes it possible to bring you the many diverse programs you hear every day on KSQD, and we are grateful. Listener support is essential to the ongoing operation of community radio, KSQD. If you haven't recently contributed, please make a tax-deductible donation at ksqd.org, and thanks.
And we're back, and we're speaking with our bold guest, Dr. Bryant Welch. Want a friend to hear this interview? Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you and your friends may listen from your favorite podcast platform, such as Apple, Google, Spotify, Radio Public, and many more. You may subscribe for free. Now, Dr. Welch, in the marketing email I sent out for this interview, I used the byline I wrote, who would have thought our democracy would become a partisan issue? And sadly, it's true. We have one party that's fighting for democracy and another one that's fighting against it. How do you think the assault on the American mind led us to this point?
Oh, I think it's the single biggest cause. You look at what our founding fathers gave us with our democratic system. They were all men at the time, so they were some pretty bright men. And I think they understood that it was going to be quite a challenge to get people to maintain their freedom. When Benjamin Franklin left the Constitutional Convention, and they said, what kind of government have you given us? And he said, we've given you a republic if you can keep it.
Right.
And so right now, when you find people who are frightened, who are confused, and it's very taxing for them to try to figure out what it is that's gone wrong in their world, they're looking for a strong man. Now, I don't know who comes to your mind, but, we've got Donald Trump out there, but we've got a lot of other people waiting in the wing.
Yes, we do.
Who are saying pretty remarkable things, trying to stir people up, and then trying to present themselves as the savior, the one who can protect them from the fear that they've generated. There are people who are not white Caucasians coming over the border, as if this country hadn't been founded and fueled by immigrants for the entire time, as if immigrant effort wasn't critical to the success of the American enterprise. And the gender issues, which scare the bejesus out of people on the deepest level, are constantly being raised. And the mind isn't able to sort these things through. I mean, the reason Donald Trump became president was because the country was not ready to recognize that a woman was fully capable of being president. There was no question about it. That's what happened. So I think the issues that I talk about in the book of those dimensions of the mind that were under assault, those are the ones that have led to the collapse of the mind, and those are the ones that have put us at this precipice where it's very much in question now whether we'll be able to maintain our democracy or whether we'll give it away. And it is divided right down party lines.
It really is. And you mentioned in your book that the mind has some main strengths, but you also say it has some shortcomings. And you talked about the mind has to make a cohesive world somehow. And if they're agitated and perplexed, that's an opening for minds getting in trouble and submitting to irrational beliefs, impossible explanations, and illogical solutions. Can you expand on that?
Well, yes, but you've done it very nicely.
Thank you.
The thing I would say is that when I mentioned that the mind's first job is to create a reality sense. Now, I'm saying a reality sense. That is a sense that I, as a being walking about in the planet, know what's going on, that I'm oriented. I don't feel terribly confused and bewildered about things. If I get confused and bewildered, I get really anxious, I get scared, and I ultimately become frightened of disintegrating. But the point that we're trying to address then is the mind has to come up with something that it at least thinks is reality. And so it's more important to the mind that it have a sense of what it believes to be reality than that reality is accurate. People can believe that the moon is made of green cheese as long as they feel confident that it's so. But if they don't know what the moon is, or they think it's some missile coming towards them or what have you, then they've got a problem. So it's not so much that it has to be rational as that it has to be coherent to them. And so now what we're seeing are some pretty irrational but surprisingly coherent views of reality. You know, that our leaders in Washington are running sex rings for children, and it's that kind of sense that we need to have be grounded by some sense of reality. And when that goes, people get very, very frightened.
Well, you also talk quite a bit in your book about gaslighting, and it contained a quote from Hannah Arendt, which I want to read and then get your input afterwards. The ideal subject of a totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the convinced communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction and the distinction between true and false no longer exist.
I think it's one of the most insightful statements from any political scientist writing in this area. And as you know, Hannah Arendt was covering covered the Eichmann trials, I think probably in the 60s. And she was fascinated by the nature of the Nazi mind, not because it was so evil, which one would think is the most striking aspect, but because of the fact that it was so unthinking, that reality could easily be sacrificed to rationalize whatever they were doing. So it's a very tenuous grip people have on reality when they're frightened and when they've got someone else who's authoritarian and telling them what to do.
Well, you also wrote that America is rapidly becoming a nation psychologically unable to confront its problems. And politically, America's been gaslighted. So what is gaslighting? Just for those that are listening that might not know the term. And how has our political system brought us to this point?
Well, the original title of the book that I submitted to the publisher was The Gaslighting of America.
Ah.
At the time, the publisher felt that no one would understand gaslighting and no one had ever heard of it. But I think today it's become much more common parlance, and gaslighting is talked about quite a bit. But gaslighting was based on the 1944 movie by the name Gaslight with Ingrid Bergman, in which a husband tries to drive a wife crazy so he can take over her inheritance. And the way in which he does it is to try to confuse her about the nature of the reality around her so she loses confidence in her own mind and eventually go crazy. And the way in which he does that, amongst other things, is to raise and lower the gas lights in the house. And when she would say, "Who raised the gas lights?" he would look at her concerned and say, "Why, dear, no one raised the gas lights. Why do you think that?" Now, so what's at play there, what's up for grabs, is the woman's reality sense. And this is what I'm talking about, is we begin to lose confidence in our reality sense, as the woman did in the movie. We then begin to doubt our overall mental functioning, and we get frightened, and we get confused, and we tend to defer to someone else's characterization of reality, no matter how crazy it may be. So gaslighting has become more and more of a popular term for when someone distorts, lies, deceives, and tries to confuse another person to the point where they don't trust their own reality sense and they succumb to the other person's imaginations.
Well, you also mentioned that there are some areas of our minds that are more vulnerable to a mix of trauma and political gaslighting than others. What did you mean by that?
Well, that's what I refer to as the real battleground states in the country. I made a reference to it. There are some areas in the mind where we're particularly vulnerable. Let's take sexuality for one that is maybe the most easily recognized. I talk about, in the book, when I was 16 years old, that was centuries ago, A gay man propositioned me one night on a beach in Maine, and the terror of that to me was just extraordinary. And I think this is what happened on a broad scale with when we had the issue of gay marriage. People would see people of the same sex kissing one another on the courthouse steps in, here in San Francisco. And it so shocked them that you have a lot of political scientists who will say that the presence of a gay marriage initiative on the ballot in Ohio is what enabled George W. Bush to carry the state of Ohio in 2004. If you scare people in that in these particular sensitive areas, it destabilizes the mind, and they don't rationally sort out one issue from another. Now, that's what I mentioned about 9/11 as well. There have been a lot of dangers to our country. I mean, I grew up during the first Cold War, and we sat there with the fear of being annihilated at any moment. But the reaction we had to that was nothing compared to this country's reaction when two or three planes ran into buildings in our country. And I think the reason for that is the violation of our boundaries. People took it as a real violation of themselves. They were much more sensitive to that than they were to the Cold War, even. So it's the boundary violation of 9/11 that I don't think people have ever recovered from. And we still are, I think, badly traumatized at the idea that we could wake up and see on our television, seeing these planes flying into these buildings. And those are the paranoid structures in our mind, the boundaries of what's in me and what's out of me. It's a bit like having a sharp stick poked in the eye when something penetrates those boundaries. So if you pick areas of paranoia, the paranoid boundaries, you pick issues concerning sexuality, then you're going to be able to disrupt and undercut the effective functioning of the mind much more readily than if you talk to them in rational political terms. And that's why we see such sensational and highly charged political advertising.
Well, I want to follow up on paranoia right after this break. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD website. And if you're just joining us, our topic is State of Confusion, Political Manipulation and the Assault on the American Mind. And we've been speaking with Dr. Bryant Welch, nationally renowned clinical psychologist and attorney. And to find out more about Dr. Welch, visit bryantwelch.com. Would you like to be added to our news group and get advance notice of our upcoming interviews? If so, please text Be Bold America at 22828. Text Be Bold America at 22828. And if you signed up already, thank you. And if you don't text, you can always email me at info@ksqd.org. We will be back with our bold guest, Dr. Bryant Welch, right after the Hightower commentary titled, How About an Award for the Sleaziest Corporate Profiteering? I'm your host, Jill Cody.
We've got the Academy Awards, the Emmys, and Grammys. But what should we call the award for the most extraordinary performance by a corporate profiteer? How about the sleazy, with winners getting a solid gold sculpture of a middle finger? There were so many worthy contenders, but one corporation exhibited uncommon callousness, so the 2021 Sleazy goes to Tyson Foods. The meatpacking giant has regularly run roughshod over workers, farmers, communities, and the environment, not to mention the millions of animals it fattens and slaughters. But the coronavirus pulled out the worst in Tyson's corporate ethic. Last April, its billionaire chair, John Tyson, ranted that health officials who were closing down several of his slaughterhouses that had become hotbeds of contagion were creating another crisis, a national meat shortage. Responding instantly, our corporate compassionate burger-gobbling president decreed that meatpacking plants were crucial to America's national security and must be kept open at all cost. Trump's edict required workers to return to their jobs or be fired. Only, there was no meat shortage. Indeed, Tyson and other giants actually increased their meat exports to China last year. Meanwhile, COVID rampaged through Tyson's factories. In its Waterloo, Iowa facility alone, a third of the processing workers were infected and at least six died. Which brings us to the corporate play that cinched this year's sleazy for Tyson. Waterloo slaughterhouse supervisors actually knew that the back-to-work order would sicken hundreds, but not exactly how many. So, managers organized a winner-take-all betting pool on the percent of employees who would test positive. It was simply something fun, said one, kind of a morale boost. This is Jim Hightower saying the virus infected more than a third of the workers in the plant. Some fun, huh? The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back. Our topic is State of Confusion, Political Manipulation, and the Assault on the American Mind. And we are speaking with our bold guest, Dr. Bryant Welch. Now, I do have a question on paranoia, Dr. Welch, but I wanted to follow up on that Hightower commentary a bit, because when I first heard it, I was just shocked and revolted when learning that Tyson's Waterloo slaughterhouse supervisors created a winner-take-all betting pool on how many of their employees who'd been forced back to work under false pretenses would get COVID as a morale booster for themselves, for the supervisors. What happens to a person's mind to even consider such a thing?
Yeah, think about what it's like inside them. We say mind, but say mind-body.
Mind-body.
Yeah. And I always think about those in that way. And I don't know. It's the kind of greed and contempt. Think what it would be like to walk around filled with that kind of greed and contempt. And I'm just not sure it would really be great to be one of those people.
No, it's very sad. What kind of life are they leading? Right.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting we waste our compassion on them, but I do think it's extraordinary of what happens with runaway greed. It just does not feel good. I've had moments of greed in my life, and it was not pleasant. And ultimately, I hopefully over the years have learned that more and more thoroughly. But it's just stunning how out of control they are, and I don't see these people having happy ever afterings. But it does illustrate. If you look at one of the things I talk about in the book, is greed is an unpleasant state. It just is, craving things and wanting things. There's a vignette I talk about with one of the, I think it was an Apache Native American chief, Biano, in the 30s, had a famous discussion with Carl Jung. And he talked about the Native Americans' perception of the white man and his greed. And he said, they're always wanting something. They're always wanting something. And he said, we think they're insane. And in many cultures, it is a form of insanity to want more than you need. And this country is, we have so loaded people with the false promise that if you can just get it all, you're gonna be okay. And this I always there's so many wealthy people I know and they have more money than God, and they're unhappy. And so they're mad at Obama, as if the little bit of money that Obama took from them is in some way ruined their dream. And so I think Jim Hightower's commentary is just so well depicts the kind of rampant greed that we're creating in our economy. The economy runs by generating greed to people's minds. And it's not a pleasant sensation.
It isn't. And you mentioned in your book that paranoia is more complex than the everyday usage of the term. And it seems like paranoia would lead into that greed, you know, can't get enough, that scarcity mentality. And you suggest that paranoia is more complex than the everyday usage of the term. And I recently heard Marjorie Taylor Greene say something that I think would instill paranoia to number 10 level. And I want to know what the psychological, long-term cycle effects of somebody saying that, as she did, saying that Democrats want to kill us, meaning Republicans, and in fact, they are doing it now, when in fact we're not. But she's saying Democrats want to kill us, and in fact, they are doing it now.
Yeah. No, yes, it's a very good question, and it's hard to remember that a lot of people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th really thought they were performing a great act of patriotism to save the country from whether they were pedophiles, from liberals and socialists and so on. They really believed that. So, and it does reflect when the mind breaks down, it becomes very frightened. Now, what do we do with that fear? Well, we try to organize it into something rational. And what is the something rational? Well, the something rational is that there are people out there trying to kill me. That's why I'm afraid.
Yes, and you sure planted that, you know. It's not even a seed. It's a full tree of paranoia with that kind of statement.
And that way their world is more organized than it would be if they just sat there and said, I'm confused, I'm very upset, I don't know what's going on. And then you have a loudmouth who comes along and says, look, they're trying to kill us, and says it with great certainty. So it takes the internal fear and it externalizes it, puts it out there where it's not inside us and is less frightening to us.
Well, you talk about gaslighting in the book, and now I know why gaslighting is such a major part of your book, because it was part of your title originally. And you have a chapter on gaslighting, but you also have a chapter on the gaslighters. Those who are the architects of false reality. I see Fox so-called news for the last two decades being a network whose sole purpose is to gaslight. What are some examples, and what impact did the advent of television have to this?
Television has been huge. And yes, I think if we lose our democracy, I would say Fox News is the single biggest culprit in it. The idea that we have just a row of demagogues lined up every night preaching hatred and intense hatred at people has just been devastating. But it does. I do describe this in the book, that the role of television has been in 1960 with the Kennedy-Nixon debates. People who listened to those debates thought that Nixon won, and people who watched them thought that Kennedy won. And for the first time, we realized what television could do, because television creates a whole psychological experience that's independent of the verbal content of what's being said. People saw John Kennedy up there, handsome, charming, and well-rested and tanned, and Richard Nixon with his jowls and gray suit and stress, And Kennedy became the TV, he was soothing. He was impressive. He was cool. And so people quickly realized that this TV instrument could really have a major effect on voters and how they made their decisions. So during the 70s and into the 80s, you had a tremendous influx of TV PR guys like Roger Ailes, who became the president of Fox News. And Ronald Reagan was such a natural TV personality that what he did is he convinced people that you really could indulge ugly passions and at the same time feel like it was morning in America and it was beautiful and wonderful. But then when George H.W. Bush came in and started doing using advertisements that really plumbed the depths of people's minds and manipulated them. Those of you who were around at the time might remember the Willie Horton ads, where Dukakis, the Democratic candidate, had a prison release program, and one of the prisoners who was released was a large African-American man named Willie Horton. And while out on release, Willie Horton assaulted a white woman. And so this was played up as Dukakis soft on crime. But what it really was a supercharged racist ad that applied and built upon all of the racist sexual ideas about blacks in America and how a black man was going to steal the white woman or rape the white woman. And it so rattled people that the other issues that were at stake in the election became irrelevant. So that's what I'm talking about, of working different areas of the mind that are unrelated to any of the real political issues. And you just stir up the mind in those particular ways. And then the next step, of course, is just to create a nonstop propaganda station. And it was incredible that Roger Ailes went from being an ad man, basically, for the Republicans to being the president of this new news station, Fox News. And they all just blithely said, oh, well, he's not in that role anymore, and we're just going to be objective. And of course, it was not. It was anything but. It's been a very powerful propaganda machine, and still is.
Well, when I read the chapter on Fox News, I felt a kindred spirit because I have read the book Outfox from beginning to end and The Loudest Voice in the Room from cover to cover. And you can't, after reading those books, think anything else in Fox so-called news is a national security risk. You know, the stochastic terrorism that they spew out back years ago was Bill O'Reilly, who would say, "Tiller, Tiller, the baby killer," so many times that someone finally killed Dr. Tiller. And then recently they're talking about the FBI and that they're corrupt and that they're out to get you. And somebody goes and tries to shoot up an FBI station. And this to me is just, is turning into a national security risk. And as you said, it's a combination of part infotainment, part news channel, and then their ever-increasing political gaslighting has just created a powerful force in American politics, shaping how many Americans form their political reality. And Roger Ailes said when he started Fox News that he saw journalism and politics as another way to monetize, to a market, to make money off of politics. And he basically said, we have no obligation to tell the viewer anything not to our advantage. And if their advantage is stochastic terrorism, gaslighting, I agree with you, Dr. Welch. I think the two decades of, well, not Fox News, but also 1,500 right-wing radio stations across the country has really done a lot to to foster that assault. Any more thoughts on that?
Well, no, I agree with you. I think it's a the communication network. I think for more progressive liberal forces, they have really not built a communication network to get their side of reality out. And it's been all a one-sided operation. You know, I don't mean there haven't been some shows like MSNBC with Rachel Maddow and so on, but I think in terms of just getting a simple coordinated message out, I think you know, think of where we'd be right now if Donald Trump were president when Putin invaded Ukraine. I mean,
wow.
Biden,
right.
I don't think Biden's getting any credit for he stepped in there after what Trump did to NATO. I mean, it was unbelievable what Trump did to NATO.
Yes.
And was in office about a year and had that organization back in shape enough that they could work in a cohesive reaction to Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Trump would have just welcomed them in. Trump's original comment and reaction to it was, those were smart moves by Putin. Now, that's what he said. He said it publicly.
I remember.
So
I do.
It's not only that Trump would not have fought him. It's also the skill and diplomacy that Biden used. All these NATO leaders had their egos bruised, to say the least, by this fellow that was his predecessor. And he put all that back together, and he hasn't even taken any credit for it.
Right.
So, you know, it's stunning what a difference it makes.
Well, before we go to break, I wanted to make this one last follow-up comment in that Donald Trump threw Skittles at Angela Merkel. Just at one of the G7 meetings or something. I mean, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Bryant Welch, author of State of Confusion, Political Manipulation and the Assault on the American Mind. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
What to Be features college students interviewing creative, surprising, passionate people about their careers. If you have ever wondered what to be, please join us Sundays, 7 p.m., KSQUID, 90.7 FM.
If you're just joining us, this is Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Well, Dr. Welch, we're in our final few minutes, but you talked about the disintegration of the American mind in a chapter, and you also talked about the possibility of resurrecting the American mind. Can you talk about that before we go for a couple minutes before we go into our ideas of what you might have and keep stop starts?
Sure, I'd be glad to. I do think if we look at what's the good news in all this? What can we do? Is there any hope? And I think there is a lot of hope. I think to begin with, we catch a tremendous break right at the front end of our attempt to resurrect the mind if we realize that just being aware of the mind. I'll come back to the word aware in a minute, but just being aware of what we're talking about solves probably half of the problem we're dealing with. Because an aware mind, awareness is really, we dismiss the word, but the word awareness talks about how the mind functions, how the mind plugs into reality. To the extent we become aware of these problems, that is half of the battle. You know, we've got people all around the country talking about theories as to what is causing the problem, And there's very little talk about the nature of the mind and how we manage the mind, keep the mind healthy, and what we can do to keep people from regressing into this slide into fascism or authoritarianism. So if you look, living in the Bay Area, one of the wonderful things about the mental health community in the Bay Area, we have had for several years now an influx of Eastern contemplative scholars. And we can call it Buddhism, we can call it mindfulness, what have you. But we do now have people looking at how the way we make our own mind function, how we cultivate awareness in the mind, how that impacts the health of our mind. And there's just tremendously good news in that, that to the extent we stop and look at our mind, not just in meditation or mindfulness, but in a global sense, personal psychological awareness breeds psychological health. Now, you take something like gaslighting. To the extent we educate people about gaslighting, of what it does when a political figure stands up and lies to people and manipulates, if you've got a growing number of people who see that and can articulate it, we can shoot it down. We can alter it. So once we're aware of these problems, there's an enormous amount that we can do. Now, following up on that awareness, as we become aware of the deeper aspects of the mind, I'm thinking here particularly of fear. Life is a scary proposition. And there is a lot to be afraid of, and there's a lot that people are afraid of. But what we find is that if people will just look at that fear, if you just look at it, a lot of it loses its impact on you. And you can begin to function in spite of the fear, and the fear begins to dissolve. You know, far back as 1932, FDR said, we've got nothing to fear but fear itself. And that was a profoundly wise psychological statement that, in fact, if we can notice our fear and not be afraid of it, but just look at it, it tends to dissolve. So we are seeing a spreading movement really across the country, I think headquartered here in the Bay Area, of using some centuries-old, millennium-old techniques that were cultivated in the eastern half of the world of meditation, mindfulness. I'm now incorporating it into the psychotherapy I do with people, but just on an everyday level, if people are aware on a deeper level, if their understanding of awareness, if their capacity for awareness increases, their mental health increases. And if you then have people who are able to articulate to other people the nature of the manipulations that are taking place, we've come a long way towards defeating the problem. Now, I don't mean to make light of that. There are some things that we have to do. The progressive community does have to have a communication mechanism. Now, that doesn't mean you get up and do propaganda like we're indicting Fox News of, but it does mean we get up and we spout some psychological truths that we deeply believe in and that will calm people. In terms of leadership, the single biggest thing a leader must do is must articulate a vision of reality that people can understand, and he or she must be insistent upon it. And I don't think the Democrats have done a very good job of that. And an example, just a few minutes ago, I was talking about with President Biden. The guy's been brilliant in what he's done with NATO at a time when, God help us, if he hadn't been there. And yet, that's not something that's being put out into the community. So, at any rate, I think there is a lot that can be done if we start with a base of understanding of what the bind is.
So I was just going to get to the keep, stop, starts. We have 1 minute. So, did you have some ideas for us?
Well, I think that's what I was describing. I think we look at different levels of participation. I think for our leadership, I think the messaging has to be better and has to be focused on stabilizing the mind, consistent with the things that I talked about in the book. I think on an individual level, I think the contemplative practices, the meditation, and the mindfulness and the kind of things that are moving into this country due to the Tibetan diaspora is those things are wonderful and can sweep through the community, and they are their own reward. So I think there are a lot of things like that that can be done. Needs to be clear. Yep.
Dr. Welch, I'm so grateful for the opportunity to speak to you today. I hope you'll come back, because I have gotten through maybe half of my questions. Come back someday, and we can talk more about the assault on the mind, this political crisis. Thank you for all you're doing to provide insights. I want people to know that this book really is brilliant, and because understanding what is happening to our mind, the assault that's happening every day through news and political lying, is really something that we have to work on. Our future depends on it. And thank you for being a bold and impressive guest today, Dr. Welch.
I've enjoyed it.
I have too. What's next on Be Bold America? On October 23rd at 5 p.m., in light of women in the United States losing rights and women in Iran fighting for theirs, we'll be speaking with Akara Sunya, author of Roar Like a Goddess. In Roar Like a Goddess, trailblazing Vedic spiritual leader Akara Sunya honors her progressive Vedic roots while breaking the shackles of tradition to bring modern-day women an inclusive feminist spirituality. Through a revolutionary revision of ancient India's primary goddess archetypes, Sunya invites us to step into our divine immensity and lead lives of power, abundance, and freedom. She writes that it is time for all women to come out of the closet and roar with all their spiritual power, because that is our true sound. So join us for Roar Like a Goddess on October 23rd at 5 p.m. I want to give a special thank you to Be Bold America's program engineer, Eliza James, and station program manager, Howard Feldstein. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online on KSQD.org. Stay tuned for Intersections with Seth Shapiro. My name is Jill Cody, and I thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.